This is the Radio Walensky Podcast. I'm Richard Walensky with new and archive interviews from the Probabilities and Bookwaves Art Waves programs on KPFA-FM and Pacifica Syndication. Robert J. Lifton, who died on September 4, 2025, at the age of 99, was a psychiatrist and author who studied the psychological causes and effects of wars and political violence. In the 1960s, he was part of a group that applied psychology and psychoanalysis to the study of history. By the 1980s and 1990s, he'd begun exploring the survivors of atrocities and war in such books as The Nazi Doctors, Medical Killing and the Psychology of Genocide, and moved on to the study of cults and what he called totalism, a term for the characteristics of ideological movements and organizations that desire total control over human behavior and thought. At the time of his death, he'd written or co-authored 23 books. On November 2, 1999, Richard A. Lupoff and I had the opportunity to speak with Robert J. Lifton about his book, Destroying the World to Save It, Aum Shinrikyo, Apocalyptic Violence and the New Global Terrorism, which focuses on the Japanese cult that released sarin nerve gas into the Tokyo subway system. While the interview serves as a time capsule for pre-9/11 America and the world, it also gives insight into the present day and how we've gotten from there to here.
Our guest is Robert J. Lifton, who has a new book, Destroying the World to Save It. Mr. Lifton's a psychiatrist. The new book is about Aum Shinrikyo, Apocalyptic Violence and the New Global Terrorism. Previously, you wrote a book on Nazi doctors, and there is a carryover in your research from that to this. So what brought you to looking at this, and how do you think it relates to the Nazi doctors and how they functioned?
Well, there is a relationship. What I talked about in my work on Nazi doctors, which I published back in 1986, was killing to heal, or the reversal of healing and killing. And there was lots of that in Aum Shinrikyo, and they did try to cultivate doctors and enlist doctors and succeeded in some degree. And they used their medical facilities to extort money from people and killed a lot of people under the guise of medical cure. So there were uncomfortable associations. But that wasn't what brought me to Aum Shinrikyo. I mean, that's consistent in my research. I came to it really through having been in Japan for other reasons, in connection with Hiroshima and Hiroshima Day 50th commemoration in 95, and also to consult on the earthquake. And Aum Shinrikyo had perpetrated its attack in March of 95, and it was disturbing the whole country. And I sensed that it really had in its function many of the things I had studied, including work with Nazi doctors, but also nuclear weapons issues and mind manipulation issues, all of which had been subjects of previous studies. So I seriously then began to study it.
Here we are several years later, and a lot of people in the United States who might have heard of Aum Shinrikyo don't know what it is now. So why don't you back up a little, tell us what Aum Shinrikyo was and what they did.
Well, Aum Shinrikyo was and still is what's called a Japanese new religion. New religions are those religions that formed separating themselves from any traditional religion, though borrowing from many of them, from the middle of the 19th century. But those that formed from 1970 are called new religions, and they tend to be a little bit more manipulative and more psychologically oriented, as indeed was Aum Shinrikyo. It described itself as Buddhist, and it was under the control of Shoko Asahara, its guru, who had a series of visions in bringing Aum Shinrikyo into being. And most of the young disciples who came to it, and some not-so-young disciples, really understood themselves to be spiritual seekers, and they found a very rewarding kind of experience in Aum Shinrikyo. including a talent for yoga teaching, which Asahara really had, and for evoking a lively and meaningful form of Buddhism as opposed to what young Japanese saw to be, the deadened state of Buddhism in Japan. Having said that, they evolved into a murderous cult which had another dimension, which was apocalyptic and saw the world as so defiled that it could only be saved by total destruction. Ordinary disciples didn't know this most of the time. And in that way, they became a destructive cult, and they took on certain principles. One is that of forcing the end, not waiting for Armageddon, but helping to bring it about. And another is a principle they called Poa, which meant under the guise of spiritual succor, they really killed people in the name of enhancing their spiritual state. I call it altruistic murder. So in their gas attack, their sarin attack in March of 95, because it was hurried and they used impure sarin, fortunately, they killed only 12 people and wounded about 5,000. It could have been in the hundreds of thousands. And they also stockpiled biological and other chemical weapons and inquired seriously about nuclear weapons. So they were the first group in history to combine religious zealotry with forcing the end, forcing Armageddon, and acquiring the weapons with which that could be done.
How many members were there in Aum Shinrikyo?
There were supposed to be about 30,000 Japanese. No, there were supposed to be about 10,000 members of Aum Shinrikyo in Japan, among which 1,500 were very close members or monks who were closest to the guru.
These were the Shukei.
Shukei, that's right. And there were supposed to be 30,000 in Russia, but that's more uncertain. The numbers are slippery. But it's just really 1,400 or 1,500 people who could terrorize Japan in this way and seem to be omnipresent in certain ways because they had enormous energy in publishing books, in Asahara appearing on television, in recruiting members, and then in their violence. Because in addition to their sarin gas attack in 1995, they apparently killed as many as 80 people individually.
When we have a group like Aum Shinrikyo, and we read about it as in a book like Robert J. Lifton's book, it seems so peculiar that it must have been a very rare, aberrant, possibly even unique phenomenon. But then as one continues through the book, it becomes obvious that this, in fact, is merely one manifestation of a fairly common pattern of behavior.
I agree with that. It's tempting to just dismiss it as an arcane cult that has nothing to do with us and from a strange culture. And it is a first of its kind in combining ultimate weapons with a project to destroy the world. But at the same time, there are emotions like it in many American cults and in many groups, political and religious, throughout the world. So it's not so unique in the kinds of emotions that it mobilized.
Well, let's look into this then. I think there's a bifurcated question here. One is, what makes a guru like Shoko Asahara and a whole list of others that we could name and that perhaps you will touch upon? The other side of that is, what makes a disciple? What makes apparently the Aum Shinrikyo people were not just a bunch of losers and dregs of society. They were highly educated, professional people, middle class and upper middle class individuals, people who, to use an expression, had a life, and threw it all away to follow this guru.
Well, a guru has something mysterious that we delude ourselves that we understand by calling it charisma. A guru possesses charisma, but what is charisma? charisma is described as the capacity to influence other people in a very powerful way. Well, that's true, but what is the source of charisma? Nobody quite knows. My own sense of what charisma is that it's a capacity to convey to people a new sense of life power, of vitality and meaning in their life, along with a sense of being part of something that is eternal and will be eternally powerful. So it's a sense of vitality and immortality which a guru can convey. To be able to do this, you usually have to have visions and a certain personal mission, which of course Asahara had. He had a vision of being told by Shiva, the Hindu god, that he's to lead an army of the gods against the forces of darkness. It was a kind of a militarized spiritual vision, and had another vision of achieving final enlightenment. So he was both a strong believer in his own near divinity and a very talented con man, as gurus often are, and they can be in the same sense of self. As for disciples, and you're right in inquiring about them, because a guru is nothing without disciples, nothing at all. They tended to be, in the case of Om Shinrikyo, relatively more educated than those of members of other cults or new religions, but they were confused young people who were antagonistic to or alienated from Japanese society. To Americans, Japanese society looks like a well-run society, a new democracy, but it's a society seething with emotions, with confusions, with uncertainties, with angers. And young people felt this, and the ones who gravitated to Om Shinrikyo tended to be very alienated. They tended to be spiritual seekers, looking for spiritual meaning in their lives, and they tended to be rather dependent young people looking for a leader or a guru whom they could follow in some strong way. So that combination really made for the guru-disciple relationship, and the guruism in Om Shinrikyo was second to none. It was overwhelming in its intensity and absoluteness, so that it was said by the guru and by disciples that they, the disciples, were supposed to become clones of the guru and nothing more.
But there's another element too. Anytime anyone attempted to pull away, or perhaps, I know, we've all had the experience of meeting someone and being taken with them and then going into another room and going, oh my God, everything that person said was bull, you know, afterward when we think about it. But in order to keep that from happening, they also had very sophisticated techniques of mind control, too.
Well, they had a series of meditations and manipulations, which included various aspects of Tibetan Buddhism. It included very intense physical forms of prostration. Above all, very rapid breathing exercises, which brought about a deoxygenation, and then one was very vulnerable to all sorts of spiritual experiences, and they then would experience what they called mystical experiences, which they so profoundly valued. And that's why when I talked to some young people a year or two or three after they had left Om Shinrikyo, they were still nostalgic for those spiritual experiences, which they felt gave them new energy. So they were drawn to the cult and to Asahara on their own. And sometimes an additional factor was the lure of his apocalypticism, because the writings of Nostradamus predicting the end of the world in the year 2000 were more translated and sold more copies probably in Japan than any country in the world. Japan's popular culture was full of apocalyptic images in their animated films, all through their television and films. There was something like 400 editions from the 1970s of the translations of Nostradamus. So young people were already very immersed in these issues and were drawn to Asahara's predictions of this kind. So I would say there was a great attraction and then much manipulation once they were there.
There seems to be an element that you talk about in your book, Destroying the World to Save It, Robert J. Lifton. You talk about that in a sense there's an after effect here of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, a peculiarly Japanese view of the world that comes from the fact that their world was destroyed?
Well, it's both peculiarly Japanese and also general, as is true of Ohm itself. I've written a lot about attraction to nuclear weapons long before I became involved with Ohm, and I call it nuclearism. And it starts with fear. We had lots of fear in this country, especially during the 50s when we had the madness of shelter building and lots of other things. And the fear is overcome by embracing the source of the fear, the weapon. And then we embrace the weapon, so did the Soviets, and so have other nuclear weapons possessing groups. Embrace the weapon as a source of power, a source of so-called national security, really as a means of keeping the world going, and that's what I call deifying the weapons. Asahara had the experience of being a Japanese, and even though he was an alienated Japanese, he was a citizen of the only country that has been victimized by the weapons, was profoundly frightened by them, spoke of Japan experiencing the future, many, many Hiroshimas, and then also in that pattern of nuclearism that I just mentioned, wanted to embrace the weapons and use them and imagine World War III, which he dreamed of starting, initiating through releasing much larger amounts of sarin gas later on. Fortunately, he never had the chance of doing it. But World War III would be accomplished by a vast nuclear holocaust. So Asahara was special in being a Japanese, but also a general in his attraction to nuclear weapons and in his form of nuclearism. And I call this trickle-down nuclearism. I didn't use that term in my book, I'm sorry to say. I just thought of it more recently, but I've just written an op-ed column about that for the Los Angeles Times, in which I speak of that process.
I want to ask a question about the time scale of movements, like Om Shinrikyo, and I've made a list here just for fun of about a dozen others, many of which you mentioned in your book, others of which I've come across in other contexts. But what happens now? Now, Shoko Asahara is a middle-aged man who is sitting in a jail cell in Japan right now. What happens to a movement like Om Shinrikyo when the leader is imprisoned? More to the point, I think, interestingly, is what happens to a movement like this after the leader's death?
Well, we're seeing some odd things happening right now in relation to Om Shinrikyo. The young people I interviewed were deeply ambivalent. They felt betrayed by him because of his violence and the preparation for which they hadn't known about, though they had resisted signs of violence within the cult. They have fended them off, so to speak, psychologically. And yet they left, but there are about 2,000 members of Om Shinrikyo right now, and the Japanese government is frightened about them. They have renounced violence, but who can be certain that they have overcome their old habits? And what they seem to be saying is that they still revere the guru. They feel that the press is trying to make him look bad in portraying him as bizarre or crazy. And they say, in effect, that ordinary people are incapable of grasping the behavior of a god or a Buddha-like figure like Asahara. And although nobody understands what he did, he'll be exonerated by history sometime in the future.
You used the word crazy, and I had already written it here on my list of questions to ask. Is this just plain crazy?
Most such gurus are profoundly paranoid and can function with their paranoia. Paranoid people can function at a reasonably high intellectual level. For instance, the American Unabomber, quite brilliant. In what he did in many ways and in what he wrote. Nonetheless, he was profoundly paranoid. Asahara had a functional paranoia and a functional megalomania within which self replaces the world. But it's precarious. It's a precarious adaptation. And there was a kind of de-guruizing process, as I called it. maybe it began even before the sarin attack and is one of the causes of the sarin attack. These groups are most dangerous when they fear that they're falling apart, when they can't get enough disciples. They could be in financial trouble, which Om wasn't, but Om was being suspected by the police. And then finally, their aggressive act with the sarin attack was in response to knowledge they obtained that there was to be a police raid 2 days later. So that they're explosive, literally, when they feel most vulnerable. However, Asahara is still a force for people, and everybody wonders what shape the new Om will take. There's a man named Joyu, whom I write about, a handsome man who, as somebody rightly said, can lie in several languages and is a kind of matinee idol for many Japanese young female teenagers. He's thought likely to be the new leader of Om, because he's about to be released from prison and was the only one among the top leadership who had not been caught with any guilty of any violent crimes. And he has expressed his continuing loyalty to Asahara. But Asahara showed signs of breakdown in this deguruizing process. A guru can stay sane only so long as he's a guru, and then he's likely to be vulnerable to breakdown, and perhaps most so when his closest disciple, a man named Inoue, renounced him publicly in open court and said he was a false guru. At that point, one of the observers whom I interviewed, who was also a former Om member, said Asahara seemed to collapse, but he had shown signs in court of bizarre behavior, bizarre movements, and statements that were delusional, like you're bombarding me with radiation right now in the courtroom, and so on. So I think he moves in and out of psychosis, from paranoia into paranoid psychosis, and this can be true of certain gurus. And he has shown signs of moving back into functional paranoia at times by claiming that he's not guilty of all these things. He seems to want to save his own life, but he has shown signs of psychosis, I would say, or at least it appears that from a distance in the courtroom.
Struck me as you were talking, and as I was thinking about other cults that you mention in the book, and also perhaps political leaders who veer into cult status, a Mao, a Hitler, Gaddafi perhaps, even Khomeini, they're all men. Is there a reason for this, or just happenstance?
There have been and are female gurus who have similar characteristics and who can evoke a similar loyalty. Perhaps the most violent gurus have mostly been men. Then again, most violence in the world is male, it would seem. And it is interesting in Om Shinrikyo, for instance, in the male-female divide, two of the most fanatical Om Shinrikyo disciples whom I interviewed were women. They were fanatical in their belief system and in their loyalty to the guru, one of whom was enormously attracted sexually and had orgiastic experiences just imagining the guru, and I wrote about that. Yet when Asahara wanted to carry out his violence, for the most part, he chose male disciples to work with, although female disciples had high positions administratively. Some of them had to know something about what was going on, but for carrying out the violence, he almost entirely chose males. So it would seem that men are more active in cultic violence, but there are and can be female gurus, and I don't think they would be immune from carrying through violent projects.
Dick Lupoff.
I thought of several instances that I'd like you to comment on in context of what you just said about male conduct and female conduct. Well, two names and one group. One name is an American guru named Elizabeth Clare Prophet. I imagine you're familiar with I think Church Militant and Triumphant is her group. Historically, Joan of Arc it strikes me, fits the pattern that you describe. And in more recent years, a group that we could call the Manson Girls.
Well, they vary. The females in the groups you've described vary. Certainly Prophet imagine the most violent kinds of events. I don't know that, and of course asked her followers to arm themselves for Armageddon. That's the level at which, for instance, David Koresh functioned in Waco. They had violent potential, but they saw themselves as defending themselves against Armageddon. And Koresh, as you know, was in no way violent until attacked foolishly and unnecessarily by official American forces, including the FBI. But, of course, women are capable of great violence. And a lot of the Armageddon imagery, even without trying to force the end, that is to be an Armageddon activist, the imagery itself is highly violent. It includes, you know, people in the lake of fire and undergoing the most violent kinds of deaths, and only those who are spiritually pure are permitted to survive. So it imagines the massive death of the great majority of people in the world. And women have certainly been capable of that. It may be that there's a parallel between the political power, predominantly male in this world, although again there are women who have been in high political positions and have not been strangers to violence, but still political power is more male than otherwise in our world, and from men there is expected more violence. Perhaps men have more violence, are prepared for more violence in their earlier lives. More is anticipated or expected from them as a possibility. For all these psychological and cultural reasons, we see much more violence from men. But one has to be very careful about saying these things, and as your question suggests, women are capable of being extraordinarily fanatical in their leadership as gurus, and they're capable of demanding or inciting enormous violence. Certainly the Manson, I've been very interested in the Manson cult, because certainly the so-called Manson girls, or the young women who Manson had recruited more or less through sexual conquest, if you want to call it that way, that's the way he built his cult originally. But it was an apocalyptic cult. Most people aren't quite aware of that. They think of it as just a, you know, a group of murderous thugs, and they became that, but they were also apocalyptic, and they wanted to force the end, and he sent out women and men to commit his murders, mostly others, and to write on the wall things like kill the pigs and pigs, to create the impression it was blacks, because that was so-called black language. Then there'd be a race war. It would create Armageddon, and Manson, as a Jesus figure, would be called upon to rule. That was forcing the end, with women playing a very prominent role, but mainly as disciples.
You discuss some of these other cults, as I say, Manson, Heaven's Gate, Jim Jones. You don't talk about fundamentalist Christian cults in this country and their apocalyptic nature. So let me ask you, are there groups in America that are under the radar now who might be considered part of the huge fundamentalist Christian umbrella that we need to fear?
There's been an enormous dissemination of Christian fundamentalism in this country over recent decades, and a close colleague of mine, Charles Strozier, has done a careful study of them in the same center that I direct, and he discovered their zealotry. But they weren't for the most, and described it in many ways, and they have in many ways a similar theology to some of the cults that we're talking about here, but for the most part they haven't been violent. Now, there are some borderline groups like Christian Identity groups, which is fundamentalist, but it has a very peculiar theology that comes from England, was modified in this country, in which the Jews are seen as literally the spawn of Satan, and not the true Israelites. The true Israelites are the Anglo-Saxons, who've had their identity taken away by this evil force, the Jews. And many in the right-wing groups who are violent believe in Christian identity or related religious beliefs, and there can be and is, in relation to Christian identity, apocalyptic events. And the unifying text is the book of Revelation. But there's a big question, and you have to look at each group individually to really determine whether it combines the book of Revelation with some form of violent function. The fact that it embraces the book of Revelation, which expresses all kinds of violence, doesn't mean that the group itself is violent. And I guess one has to say that most people who practice Christian fundamentalism see themselves in a religious setting. Sometimes they can be cult-like. Most of them aren't specifically violent. And we have to focus on the potentially violent ones who have some of the other characteristics that we've been talking about.
Are the events at places like Columbine High School in any way related to what we're talking about here, or is that just something from out of left field?
I think they are related. You know, if you look into what happened at Columbine, they formed a little kind of junior cult there, which only they, who were sort of the downtrodden, the non-jocks and the ones who didn't believe in God, belonged to. They also seem to make as their models some of the radical right groups whom they studied on their websites and tried to imitate them. So they were like junior right-wing violent types. And in that sense, just as I said, there's a trickle-down nuclearism, there can be a trickle-down violence from right-wing examples or exemplars who become models for young people. And everything is so accessible these days through the mass media revolution and the internet. Everything can be immediately accessible, and in that sense, influence can be spread. So, yes, and of course, another dimension to that is something that has to be said in relation to that, what I call American gunism or the American gunocracy. These are ugly words, but they describe an ugly process historically and psychologically. And American cultic behavior gets bound up with the gun. And so these radical right groups, they describe, and this is very much in the novel, The Turner Diaries, which is the American Mein Kampf, really, and ends up in nuclear holocaust, in which all non-whites and all Jews and non-whites throughout the world are literally killed. But the white revolution begins with a threat to take away guns, and right-wing groups are always intensified in their energies, violent or otherwise, by the threat or fear of guns being taken away. So the relation to the gun becomes cultic and extreme, and that was another factor in Columbine, where these young kids got hold of guns and brandished them like full-fledged right-wingers, who in turn have this deified relationship to the gun as an iconic object.
Is this relationship to the gun as an iconic object, to use your phrase, maybe I'm just being silly and literal-minded, but it strikes me that there's some Freudian imagery there which is unescapable.
Well, there's lots of Freudian imagery, but you have to be both historical and psychological. So I would start with the historical. The Freudian imagery, let's say, is obvious. It's male. Is the gun like a penis? Well, it is. But that's only one part of the matter, and it becomes tied in with maleness and macho. But that could only happen because of the historical psychology in relation to the gun, where the militias and their being individually armed have been glorified and romanticized as having been the source of victory in the American Revolution. And this has, of course, been fed by the gun lobbies and by economic interests to a very great degree. so that it became, the gun became an iconic object, and to take it away was to be un-American and to go against the grain of our true nature and our true history. With that kind of relationship to the gun, I was in thinking about this and in writing about it, some people spoke to me about how they had been really gun lovers without ever being violent, because it was a beautiful object, and some Southerners are brought up with guns. And I spoke to a high-ranking Newsweek editor who said he grew up with guns and used to say in his uncle's house in the gun room, but they never were violent. They were just about them all the time. These people then have come to see themselves in many cases as having been manipulated by this gunocracy, and having been, in a sense, without understanding what they were doing, having joined their camp. And some of them are now questioning all that. So this historical connection with the gun then can join in with a kind of cult of maleness. For instance, in some inner city subcultures, you're not a man until you have a gun. But that's both social and psychosexual, one can say. And you can see I'm emphasizing the historical and the social even more than the psychosexual.
If we could revert for a moment to the peculiar mixture of religion, politics, violence, and all these other things we've been talking about. Especially, I know that you teach at John Jay College, which is in the city of New York. Were you in New York at the time of the World Trade Center bombing?
Yes, I was. And I was giving a course together with a colleague at the Graduate Center, in which we took up various forms of fundamentalism and the potential for violence. So what is your further...
Well, my further question is, regards the overlap of what we would see as
yes.
a religious movement with a political movement with a violent militants.
Yes, they completely overlap, so that... Well, for instance, if you take Middle Eastern violence, which in a way extended into New York and America with the World Trade Center bombing, it's both political and religious. But almost all such violence is both political and religious, and in a sense it's a false distinction for these groups. Because when a violent Arabic group or Palestinian group sets off bombs or kills people, of course they want to interfere with the peace process, but they also want to conduct a holy war. It has a profoundly religious principle that is apocalyptic in the extreme, and the same is true for Jewish terrorists. When Rabin was shot by a Jewish terrorist, a religious Jewish terrorist, he did it out of his religious conviction, and he wanted to stop the peace process. But why did he want to stop the peace process? Because he really viewed the giving away of Jewish land as evil, and therefore would delay the coming of the Messiah. So in order to enhance the coming of the Messiah, you had to get rid of the man, Rabin, who was committing this evil act. And in that sense, there's a complete overlap between the religious and the political. And that was very true in Om Shinrikyo. It was even true of the Nazis and the whole Hitler movement. They were primarily political, as we know, but full of religious imagery, the Thousand-Year Reich, and religious in their impulse and in their loyalty and in their cult of the leader. So when you get an apocalyptic group, it can come from a political or religious source, and there's always enormous overlap.
You speak in your book about cults and the danger of their getting the kind of weaponry that could do real apocalyptic violence. However, at the same time, we also know about political leaders and dangers involved with them. I recall in the 80s, the Reagan administration set up what we call designated Hitlers, being Gaddafi was one, Noriega was one, and of course later on we had Saddam Hussein. Putting aside the political reasons for setting up these straw men to attack, how dangerous are some of these people who are in positions of power who do have the kind of weaponry?
See, I think that the very existence of nuclear weaponry in particular, and to a maybe a slightly lesser extent, biological and chemical weaponry, but the very existence of nuclear weaponry in particular is dangerous in the world. And now one can see, I think, from my study of Aum Shinrikyo, that the weapons are an irresistible lure for other countries, so that I mean the term trickle-down nuclearism. Of course, it's a Reaganite term, but it applies as much to nuclearism, maybe more to nuclearism than to economics as it was originally used, because, you know, the whole rationale of the test ban treaty and of the non-proliferation treaties has been that the powers that possess the weapons take strong and regular steps to diminish and rid themselves of the weapons completely. That's written into these treaties. As long as you don't, you create an irresistible lure on the part of lesser powers, medium-sized powers. It is a danger for someone like Saddam Hussein to have these nuclear weapons. I've been friendly with some of the UN people who've told me about their work in Iraq, and it's been written about, and it is really terrifying, because one wonders whether someone like Hussein would hesitate to use them. But the model for possessing them and threatening to use them was created by the United States and the Soviet Union, as they looked across the weapons at each other and threatened their use in the very concept of deterrence, which always had a threat of potential use under certain circumstances. And that model is then embraced by lesser powers militarily who want to acquire them because they become a symbol of power. And now it's extended further down, trickling down to cults like Aum Shinrikyo, who now themselves have created a model of a cult obtaining biological and chemical weapons and seriously attempting to obtain nuclear weapons. So other cults could follow that model.
I guess one question which comes to me, and it's probably one you've been asked at the end of virtually every interview, is there anything any of us can do? Is there any way we can proceed to either keep the number of cults down or stop the possibility of a more dangerous group than Aum Shinrikyo, or rather, you know, maybe a more competent one coming along and doing that kind of damage?
It's not an easy question to answer, and if somebody gives a simple answer, you can be skeptical. But there are times when you need to use police power against groups when they're violent. But I think there are probably more times when trying to make contact with groups that are potentially violent, particularly in their paranoid views about the government or other groups, and conducting dialogue, and here advice from some of the people who've closely studied these cults can be constructive. But the larger issue comes, and that's important, the larger issue comes down to the kind of society we are and have. I think people are most prone, most vulnerable to these cults when they feel excluded from the society. A lot of people who joined right-wing movements that became violent had lost their farms in the West or the Midwest, were in under economic duress, and had also lost their raison d'etre, their sense of meaning in their lives. It's not easy to replace these things, but in very general terms, the more decent a society we are, and the more we spread the benefits of our society to include all of our people, the less likely these cults are to form and to become violent.
Regarding Donald Trump, in Losing Reality on Cults, Cultism, and the Mindset of Political and Religious Zealotry, which was published in 2019, Dr. Lifton wrote this: Donald Trump is a special kind of cultist. He is in no way totalistic. His beliefs can be remarkably fluid, nor is he the leader of a sealed-off cult or community. Rather, his cultism is inseparable from his solipsistic reality. A considerable portion of his base can be understood as cultist, as followers of a guru who is teacher, guide, and master. From my study of cults and cult-like behavior, I recognize this aspect of Trump's relationship to his followers. Trump does not directly express an apocalyptic narrative, but his presence has an apocalyptic aura. He tells us that, as not only a genius but a very stable genius, he alone can fix the terrible problems of our society. To be sure, these are bizarre expressions of his extreme grandiosity, but also of a man who would be a savior to a disintegrating world. You've been listening to an interview with the late Robert J. Lifton, who died on September 4, 2025, at the age of 99. The interview was recorded on November 2, 1999, in the KPFA studios while he was on a book tour for Destroying the World to Save It, Om Shinrikyo, Apocalyptic Violence and the New Global Terrorism. My co-host was Richard A. Luboff. Until next time, I'm Richard Walensky. Radio Walensky usually posts every week on Sundays. You can write to me either at bookwaves@hotmail.com or richard@kpfa.org. You can find other Radio Walensky podcasts in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org, or you can go to bookwaves.homestead.com or richardwalensky.com for a complete listing of all digitized recordings. You can subscribe to Radio Walensky via iTunes or follow Richard Walensky Radio Shows on Facebook.